Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, previously we heard how Bridgeshura, who was a great demon, was also able to develop deep love for the Lord, and this baffled Prudhik Maharaj. And therefore we're hearing this story of Chitraketu, who became Bridgeshura in his next life due to the curse of Parvati when Chitraketu laughed at Lord Shiva. So what happened was that Chitraketu, he was a king, he had many millions of wives, and yet he was unable to have any children due to all of his queens being barren. And the powerful sage Angira happened to travel there, and the king received him very nicely, and Angira gave him the benediction that he asked for, which was that he get a son. But he did explain to him that that son, through his queen creature Judy, would be the cause of both lamentation and jubilation, and that's because when the son arrived, there was great jubilation, and then very soon he died, and there was great lamentation. And this brought the king practically to his knees in extreme lamentation, and all the citizens as well became very lamented very much. So then we're up to chapter 15, and in chapter 15 we're going to hear what Angira says and Narada Muni when they returned to the king. And why they would give such a benediction, seems strange, doesn't it? But, such nice saintly personalities give a benediction which causes so much lamentation. So we're going to hear about that, and also about the illusory nature of material existence and how one should seek to attain the reality that we're an eternal soul, everything is being done in this world, although it's illusion, the background is Krishna, even though we think that we are doing everything. When one comes to that knowledge, one becomes free from all lamentation and false happiness. So we're going to hear that. And then we should be able to move through this chapter quite quickly. It's not a difficult subject matter. There's only about 29 verses. And then what we'll do is we'll move into chapter 16 today. Chapter 16 is how Chitraketu, by chanting various mantras and devotional service, actually attains association with the Lord and in the form of Lord Sankarshan, who will soon arrive here, hopefully, if that's today. Would you be able to go and see Srimurti, who's, I think, in the Jagu room soon, and ask her when she's bringing Sankarshan? Sometimes people talk to her and she may call her. So I'll read the chapter summary. In this chapter, Angira Rishi, along with Narada, consults Chitraketu as far as possible. Angira and Narada Rishi came to relieve the king from excessive lamentation by instructing him about the spiritual significance of life. And of course, this is what we do in ISKCON, exactly the same thing. We help people, everyone suffering in the material world, and we help them get out of that by instructing them about the spiritual significance of life. The great saints Angira and Narada explain that the relationship between father and son is not factual. It is simply a representation of the illusory energy. The relationship did not exist before, nor will it stay in the future. By the arrangement of time, the relationship exists only in the present. One should not lament for temporary relationships. The entire cosmic manifestation is temporary. Although not unreal, it is not factual. By the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, everything created in the material world is transient. By a temporary arrangement, a father begets a child, or a living entity becomes the child of a so-called father. This temporary arrangement is made by the Supreme Lord. Neither the father nor the son exist independently. As the king listened to the great sages, he was relieved from his false lamentation, and then he inquired about their identity. The great sages presented who they were and instructed that all sufferings are due to the bodily conception of life. When one understands his spiritual identity and surrenders to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the supreme spiritual person, one becomes actually happy. When one searches for happiness in matter, one must certainly lament for bodily relationships. Self-realization means spiritual realization of one's relationship with Krishna. Such realization ends one's miserable material life.
She said she's been here now. Okay.
Text number one. Sukadeva Goswami, he said, while Chitraketu, overcome by lamentation, lay like a dead body at the side of the dead body of his son, the two great sages, Narada and Angira, instructed him about spiritual consciousness as follows. O king, what relationship does the dead body for which you lament have with you? And what relationship do you have with him? You may say that you are now related as father and son, but do you think this relationship existed before? Does it truly exist now? Will it continue in the future? So he's helping him to point out that he's helping the king to understand that basically the present relationships we have in this world are in fact to be considered an illusion. That's where these questions are leading to. O king, as small particles of sand sometimes come together and sometimes separated due to the force of the waves, the living entities who have accepted material bodies sometimes come together and are sometimes separated by the force of time. So, Prabhupada quotes this verse from the Bhagavad Gita 2.13. Showing the transient nature of, showing the nature of the soul, different from the body. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. Prabhupada summarizes, we are not the body, we are spiritual beings trapped in the body. That's what that verse is trying to tell us. Our real interest lies in understanding this simple fact. Now that understanding, once this is the foundation of self-realization, of helping people to get out of material consciousness. I'm not the body, I'm the eternal soul. Once they understand that, they can understand their real interest. Jai. Thank Jan Bhagavan Ki Jai.
Oh yeah, sorry. Excuse me. Bhagavan.
The ultimate swami.
The ultimate guru.
Yeah. We're going to hear about that. Thank you, Srimati. Then we can make further spiritual progress. Spiritual life begins from that point. Otherwise, if we remain in the bodily concept of life, our miserable material existence will continue forever. And then from that we can understand something again extremely significant, which is part of our preaching. Political adjustments, social welfare work, medical assistance and all other programs we had manufactured for peace and happiness will never endure. We shall have to undergo the sufferings of material life one after another. Practically every welfare or material arrangement made, from political to medical to educational in this world, is useless, in fact, ultimately, to a person coming to the platform of actual reality and happiness. They only lead to birth and death. It's a really strong statement, isn't it? It just really, you know, all the good work that they apparently throughout the whole world, it is basically useless. If you're looking at the interests of the soul. If you're looking at the interests of the body, fine. Problem is, even then, you're not going to solve the problems of the body. Birth and death, suffering will go on. So it's basically useless once you understand the spiritual. So, you know, such powerful points there, which a devotee, you see when Prabhupada, he met the leaders from, you know, he used to, wherever he travelled, he'd say, you know, he'd want the leaders, you know, the social workers, the politicians, the scientists, come in and he'd just present the same thing. Useless, useless, useless. You know, in a way that they used to laugh and enjoy. Yeah, even though they challenged him, but, you know, he would show it. Useless waste of time. You've got to come to the spiritual platform for that. So these are people who, you know, you would think, oh, what's Prabhupada? He doesn't have a science degree. He's not trained in politics. He's not trained in social welfare. How's he going to speak to these really well-educated people in all these, you know, different spheres? He just cut them down with this basic philosophy like that. So a devotee is not fearful to speak to anyone. Even though they don't have their academic qualifications, they are not intimidated to speak to anyone, no matter how self-important they are in this world, on the basis of this simple understanding that's here in this purport. Very, very profound.
Well, what's the argument that we can provide when people can say that they're materially chaotic, absolutely. It's like they don't have stuff. Like, you know what I mean? It's like it's a chaotic condition.
The material chaos is there because they're not following the Bhagavad Gita. And that's stated here. If they follow the Bhagavad Gita, there wouldn't be material chaos. Therefore, Prabhupada said, he said, in India, the politicians should have, you know, the government should have one department. So you have the Department of Defence, you'd have the Department of Finance, and you have the Department of Bhagavad Gita. A whole department of the Bhagavad Gita, because that is, and India especially, but the whole world. Otherwise, this instruction about the soul will never be understood. It is understood from the Gita. Prabhupada quotes, you know, 2:13 from the Bhagavad Gita. What's the first verse that Krishna says? He says, Arjuna, you're speaking like a learned person. All this social talk and politics and duty and everything like that. But you're lamenting for the body which is not worthy of grief. The next verse he says, actually we're all eternal. The proof is in this verse 2:13. You look at it with your intelligence and you'll see, yes, you're a spirit soul. Okay. So, literally within the first instruction of the Bhagavad Gita on the spiritual platform, all of the problems of the world are solved by understanding that first instruction. And every other program is revealed to be useless. Because they're all based upon the body, and people should not lament about the situation of the body. So, you know, very, very important. So we're up to verse number 3. Sorry, in chapter 15. And we looked especially at that second paragraph there. Extremely important, fundamental understanding for a devotee. Now, I think with Kesava Prabhu, when he did, there were some printouts I saw, when they do, you know, the 24th unit, what he did, where you're supposed to do a presentation, he seemed to do a presentation on Arjuna. That's, you know, from his notes from what I saw. But the actual, you know, in the actual manual, which I got, it actually asks what is it, you know, to describe the qualities of being a bhakti by bhakti. And it's this sort of fundamental understanding that you have as a bhakti by bhakti, you know, which allows you to preach effectively to anyone in any position in this world. And it's things like this in this purport you should be drawing out. There are other things. This is a very important chapter. In fact, you know, in your presentations as a bhakti by bhavi, you can draw so many discussions from this chapter, this particular pastime of Chitra Ketu. So bear that in mind. So we go to text 4. When seeds are sown in the ground, they sometimes grow into plants and sometimes do not. Sometimes the ground is not fertile and the sowing of seeds is unproductive. Similarly, sometimes a prospective father, being impelled by the potency of the Supreme Personal, by the Supreme Lord, can beget a child, but sometimes conception does not take place. Therefore, one should not lament over the artificial relationship of parenthood, which is ultimately controlled by the Supreme Lord. Prabhupada begins the purport that actually Maharaj Chitra Ketu is actually not destined to get a son. So, now, what the sages are trying to do is throw his consciousness to this. This is the arrangement of the Lord. Don't lament over that. You know, the Supreme Personality of Godhead wisely decides you're not destined to have a son. You should understand that's in that's for the benefit of all living entities, all creation. The Lord does not do anything to disturb anything in creation. because all of creation is not different from himself. No, he was not destined to have a son. Because he was not just a king, he's actually a spirit soul, and he's a spirit soul who actually is a devotee of the Lord, who has sort of fallen from that consciousness. And not being destined to have a son is to help him come back to his spiritual consciousness. If they were going to help him as a king, yes, give him a son. But to help him as a devotee, no son. So he married hundreds and thousands. We know it was actually 10 million wives. All of them barren. Now, what is the background of that? You know, that's beyond his control, isn't it? That you can choose 10 million wives, but, you know, still, with that amount, the one that could have produced a child, you didn't pick. You know, this is arranged in the Lord. That's beyond him. He could not get one child. Now, Prabhupada gives us a little clue here, which comes up further in the chapter, that when Angira Rishi came to see the king requested the sage to enable him to have at least one. Because of the blessing of Angira Rishi, a child was sent by the grace of Maya. But the child was not to live for long. Therefore, in the beginning, Angira Rishi told the king that he would beget a child who would be the cause of jubilation and lamentation. So by the arrangement of Krishna, by the Lord, he was not destined to have a son. Due to the benediction of Angira Muni, he was given a temporary son by the arrangement of Maya, and the arrangement of Maya always causes duality. Well, that comes up. Let's have a look further at this purport. It says here that as the example is given here, just as a sterile grain cannot produce more grain, a sterile person by the will of the Supreme Lord cannot beget a child. Then he says sometimes a child is born even to an impotent father and a sterile mother. Right? So that's something quite miraculous. The father's impotent, the mother's sterile, and still the child gets born. And sometimes a potent father and fertile mother are childless. Now, indeed, sometimes a child is born despite contraceptive methods. So sometimes parents, they're both potent or fertile, and they decide not to have children. So they use contraceptives, and they get a child anyway. and therefore they kill the child in the womb. In the present age, killing children in the womb has become a common practice. Why? When contraceptive methods are taken, why don't they act? Why does the child sometimes produce so that the father and mother have to kill it in the womb? We must conclude that our arrangement of so-called scientific knowledge cannot determine what will take place. What is enacted actually depends on the supreme will. So, if we actually examine the birth of children in this world, it will be found that things happen by the will of the Lord, even though materially they should not have happened. So, it is by the supreme will that we are situated in certain conditions in terms of family, community and personality. These are all arrangements of the Supreme Lord according to our desires under the spell of Maya or illusion. So he's making the arrangements, but because we want it. Here comes a caution for devotees. In devotional life, therefore, one should not desire anything, since everything depends upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Anya bilasa dasunyam yana kamadina vritam anukulyena krishna anushilanam bhakti uttama. He's describing the very topmost level of pure devotional service. If you want to consider oneself on the level of pure devotional service, one should render transcendental loving service to the Supreme Lord Krishna favourably and without desire for material profit or gain through fruitive activities or philosophical speculation. That is called pure devotional service. Now naturally, we've discussed this previously, we won't go into it in depth. Not all the devotees are on the platform of Uttama Alikari, that they can become, you know, completely desireless. And sometimes, you know, on the platform of the Kanishta or the Majjhima Alikari, we may, you know, have strong desires. We cannot overcome that. We want something, but at least we want it for the purpose of attaining pure devotional service. Then that's acceptable. We should not desire things separate from that attaining the platform of pure devotional service. We can't imitate Uttama Adhikaris. You know, therefore, men generally, you know, and women generally desire a wife and a husband, a family, to keep them nicely situated, and it helps them to, you know, steadily get to that platform of pure devotional service. And if they imitate an Uttama, no, you know, I'm going to just take sannyas, even though I really would like a wife or a husband, I'm just going to be, you know, then they'll fall down. This is discussed a little further in the eighth canto in relationship to Gajendra and the crocodile, that one should be situated on, you know, one's natural, you know, position of strength. And that. So, but still, you know what pure devotional service, you know what a pure devotee is when you understand that they're not desiring anything. What does he say? One should act only to develop Krishna consciousness. And as we said, even on the platform of the Kanishta and the Majjhima, if there are some desires that they're praying to Krishna for, but it is for the development of Krishna consciousness, then that's acceptable. And in the long term, gradually one has no desires, one just leaves it to Krishna. For everything else, one should fully depend upon the Supreme Person. That's one of the principles of surrender, to be dependent upon the Lord and to be confident that the Lord will, you know, give one shelter. That's the principles of surrender mentioned in the Nectar of Instruction. But we can't imitate that. We have to try and come to that platform fully. We should not create plans that will ultimately make us frustrated. Exactly.
That's what I was coming to. Like,
yeah.
How to relate Chitraketu's thing to us and say, should we not do the same thing? Or
in our society, you know, see, when Prabhupada began the movement, it was an emergency situation. There was no Krishna consciousness movement properly, you know, international society for Krishna consciousness to save people from, you know, material life. It had to be established somehow or another. In order to do that, you know, he was initiating people practically. Sometimes he just happened to be there in the initiation. He was creating sannyasis who'd been around for a couple of years. You know, he was pushing hard. But Prabhupada was so potent a devotee that he was able to basically bring, you know, those personalities to a level of, you know, surrender that was not achievable after many, many lifetimes of devotional service. That's his potency. So, you know, he was empowered to do that. We can't imitate Prabhupada. Oh, yeah, I'm just going to, you know, people are going to come to my class and all going to walk out sannyasis. We can't imitate Prabhupada. That's number one. Nor are we in the emergency situation Prabhupada was in, where he was one person trying to establish a whole movement. That's not our movement now. We're established over 50 years. So we should, you know, not falsely, expect everyone to act on the platform of Uttam Adhikari without any desires, without any contaminations. We have to somehow accommodate that within our preaching so that from wherever a person is, we're not disturbing their minds, but we're just helping them take the next step. If you push too hard, you're just going to disturb a devotee's mind and they will actually freak out. And it causes both that individual and the movement problem. So I'm not going to go into some stories, but I could fill up the next 14 classes with just horror stories. But I'm not going to go into that. So we should be mature about that. Okay. O King, both you and us, your advisors, wives and ministers, as well as everything, moving and not moving throughout the entire cosmos at this time, are in a temporary situation. Before our birth, this situation did not exist. And after our death, it will not exist no longer. It will exist no longer. Therefore, our situation now is temporary, although it is not false. Prabhupada explains that the Mayavadi philosophers say, Brahma Satyam Jagam Mithya. Brahman, the living being, is factual, but his present bodily situation is false. According to the Vaishnava philosophy, however, the present situation is not false, but temporary. And a good analogy, it's like a dream. A dream does not exist before one falls asleep, nor does it continue after one awakens. The period for dreaming exists only between these two, and therefore it is false in the sense that it is impermanent. So when we say it's false or illusory, we mean it's impermanent. Similarly, the entire material creation, including our own creation and those of others, is impermanent. We do not lament for the situation in a dream before the dream takes place or after it is over. And so during the dream or during a dream-like situation, one should not accept it as factual and lament about it. This is real knowledge. So, speaking of dreams, so as you know, I haven't been here for about the last month because I had the viral meningitis, which on reflection just about killed me. Because I know I was speaking to the headmistress at Varuna School, and she said she had a friend who had that, who died within 3 hours, and which I could relate to, because in the first couple of days I had headaches which were so severe, it was, you know, the maximum pain that I could possibly tolerate, and it never let up for 1 second, night and day. And just due to being so physically weak, I had a lot of pain in the rest of my body. But when I was sleeping, I was having a lot of nightmares. 99% of my nightmares were that there are all these services I had to do which other devotees were doing and creating all these different problems, and somehow I was unable to fix it. That was 99% of my nightmares. And then, you know, I'd be so, you know, disturbed, and then I'd wake up and I'd look and I'd say, I'm just in my bedroom. I'm just laying in bed, and actually all I have to do is try and rest. There's nothing else for me to do. It's just a dream. You know, it's not factual. And then I'd go back to sleep, and then again another like that. And it just went for days like that. So, but, you know, I remember waking up and that sense of relief. I don't actually have to get involved in anything. I don't have any arrangements to make. I don't have any phone calls. I don't have to discuss with anyone. I just have to lay here and get better, and that's it. So, but during that, I also, you know, was thinking, in fact, because I was feeling, you know, you know, probably the next time I go through something like this, that'll be the finish. I'll probably be too old to survive something like that. And I was thinking, you know, I've probably got so many years left, and then, you know, I'll go through something like this and I'll be dead and I'll be, you know, going back. So basically everything in this material world is like that. It's temporary. I'm coming to the end now, you know. I'm not a young boy anymore. I'm sort of getting closer and closer to death and having more and more, you know, near-death experiences. So I was actually thinking like that. And this, you know, all the relations. I was lying there. I was thinking, I'm lying in this home. I'm going to have to leave this home. You know, if I died now, I'd be leaving my wife, my family, everything. You know, all finished like that. And but that's a devotee. As devotees, we should actually be in that mood at every moment, even when things are going really nicely. You know, we've got a good job, we've got, you know, good money coming in, we've got nice food, we've got nice relatives, nice friendship, nice society like that. You know, because in general, a lot of people come to the temple for a good social life. A lot of people come to the temple to enjoy a good social life, good prasadam. You know, they become a little bit more peaceful. They control their mind and senses, their life gets a little bit more together, they make some good decisions like that. But we should be very careful getting in that comfort zone. You know, the reality is, you know, everything is in this whole world is just temporary, it's just illusion, it'll all be finished soon, and then, so we should not accept it as, you know, our factual life, but just, this is, you know, the whole thing is just a temporary illusion. In the past life, we were doing a whole bunch of different things with different people. We don't even care about it now. We're absorbed in it completely, just like we're absorbed in everything this year. And if we take birth again, we don't care about anything in this life. We don't care about anything at all. So it really is just an illusory situation, and, you know, a devotee treats it like that. At the same time we're treating it like that, we're also very fully conscious of what's happening in this world because we're trying to preach. So for the benefit of preaching and becoming Krishna conscious, we take very careful notice. So although we treat it like a dreamlike situation, we don't walk around in a daze not noticing things and anything like that. It was like one time Prabhupada, he was visiting one office, I think in New York, they were seeing publishers or something. They went into the entrance. Prabhupada says to his disciples, "What was the sign on that front door when we come in?" And they said, "I don't know, Prabhupada." And he said, "You should notice everything. You know? Because, you know, we're preaching, for, you know, we're serving Krishna, you should notice." But they were just oblivious. Prabhupada said, "You should notice everything." So just because we, treat it as illusion, this is another fault that you can have in ISKCON, which we have had, which we don't want to have again. Which is still there, but we gotta, it's not as bad. Yes, everything is illusion, but don't treat your wife and your children, your husband, your friends, your service, your work, your workmates, your boss, the tidying in the house and the toilet. Don't treat them as, it's all illusion. I'm not going to take any notice of it. Or, we take interest because we're utilizing everything in Krishna's service. So, that combination is very important. Otherwise, it's artificial renunciation. And of course, again, this is why we do the Bhakti Vaidhava, because there's a lot of misapplication.
A lot of people struggle with health big time.
Don't neglect their health.
They can't, they can't lift Prabhupada, so they have to give up their services. So it's all because of
these rules. That's right. People should not neglect.
Well,
yeah.
How can we really, where it's like 1 foot here, 1 foot there, and
by doing exactly what you're doing. You're here, try and understand Srimad Bhagavatam properly and which is exactly what you're doing, and then just, lock that into your consciousness and apply it. Don't be disturbed that all the devotees you meet are not applying this. Because, as we said, we can't push devotees to be above their situation. That means, children, family, people who come to the temple. We can't. They can only act on the according to the spiritual qualifications they're on, and then we can patiently and compassionately help them advance. But you can't just give instruction to someone who doesn't have the spiritual qualification and expect them to just take that up in 1 second. So we Bhakti Vaibhava, we see how few people come to Bhakti Vaibhava. To take the trouble to study the whole 6 chapters properly. And if they don't, they'll just gradually read a few of these verses here and there and like that, and you won't get the same understanding unless it's hearing it properly from devotees in classes and what have you. Just studying it a little bit more haphazardly doesn't produce the same effect. So we should apply it ourselves, take the great opportunity, but be very careful not to overly pressure others. But we sort of guide them always in the right direction. So, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Master and Proprietor of everything, is certainly not interested in the temporary cosmic manifestation. Nonetheless, just as a boy at the beach creates something in which he is not interested, the Lord, keeping everything under his control, causes creation, maintenance and annihilation. He creates by engaging a father to beget a son. He maintains by engaging a government or king to see the public's welfare. And he annihilates through agents for killing, such as snakes. The agents for creation, maintenance and annihilation have no independent potency. But because of the spell of the illusory energy, one thinks himself the creator, maintainer and annihilator. So the Lord, as we said, he's enjoying the spiritual world. He has no interest in getting anything, any benefit from the material world. But, you know, it's a pastime for him. Just a little boy will, you know, create sandcastles, knowing that the tide's going to come and smash them away, and he knows that he's going to go home and leave them there. It's a pastime. So although it's a pastime, he's not attached to it, but he takes full control of it, creation and maintenance. And just because he's not interested doesn't mean that he's not fully, you know, causing everything. Right? And he, how does he do it? For creation, he creates like a father. The father begets a son. For maintenance, he creates kings and governments. And for annihilation, he creates snakes and, you know, different warlords and things like that. Now, Prabhupada quotes this verse from the Bhagavad Gita. Prakriti Kriyamanani 3.27 Gunai Kamani Savashaha Hankara Vamudatma Kata Hamiti Manyate. The bewildered spirit soul under the influence of the three modes of material nature thinks himself the doer of activities that are in actuality carried out by nature. They're thinking, I'm the creator of these children. I'm the maintainer of this, you know, establishment. I'm the destroyer of, you know, these, whatever, like that. You know, it's quite interesting because, as you know, whenever I do a ceremony, usually I read a verse from the Gita. And I just read the next verse that I'm up to in the Gita. So I just, so that, you know, people come in for a ceremony, I read that verse. And if I do the next ceremony, I just read the next verse and I just go through all 18 chapters. Sometimes, because some verses are in sections, I need to read a little section for the people to understand it. Sometimes I'll read half a chapter if it's a Shraddha ceremony and I'm reading a significant portion of the Gita. So the last ceremony, one of the last ceremonies I did was the lady was 8 months pregnant. And I read this verse. This is the exact verse. And I was speaking to the father that one who thinks they're the body, they think, I'm creating the child. And I said to the mother, I said, you've come here to do a ceremony because you know that what's happening in your body is beyond your control. That's happening by the material energy under the control of the Lord, and you want his blessings because you know you have no control over it and you want the mercy of the Lord to make sure everything goes right. So it's interesting, you know, that this verse is here. That was the last. So, but you know, on reflecting on this, again, it just highlights how, you know, Krishna literally choosing verses for the different people to come along, and I'm just like a mouthpiece. But but that was it. They're pretty much a 2-minute talk. And that's it, finish. And they immediately got the point, and then I just move on to a little kirtan. Sometimes the less you say, the more they remember. So then, as we see, Prakriti, material nature, as directed by the Supreme Lord, induces all living entities to create, maintain, or annihilate. But the living entity, without knowledge of the Supreme Person and his agent, the material energy, thinks he is the doer. That's the essence of that verse. In fact, he's not the doer at all. He's not at all the doer. As an agent of the Supreme Doer, the Supreme Lord, one should abide by the Lord's orders. The present chaotic conditions of the world are due to the ignorance of leaders who forget that they have been appointed to act by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because they have been appointed by the Lord, their duty is to consult the Lord and act accordingly. The book for consultation is Bhagavad Gita, in which the Supreme Lord gives directions. Therefore, those who are engaged in creation, maintenance and annihilation should consult the Supreme Person who has appointed them and should act accordingly. Then everyone will be satisfied and there will be no disturbances. So here again, you see this important statement which Prabhupada, in all of his conversations and all of his lectures, pointed out to people. The chaos in this world is due to you not following the instructions of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. And if you want to fix the problems of the world, you must. Everyone, in some way or another, whether they're, you know, bringing up children, they need to follow, that's creation, they need to follow the Bhagavad Gita. If they're leaders of the world, they need to follow the Bhagavad Gita. And we know in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that Sanatana Goswami, when he spoke to the Qazi who threw him in jail, he offered him the respect. You're the ruler, you are the representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He wasn't saying that, sarcastically. So therefore he was saying, so whatever you do, you know, then what can I, you know, I can't go against that. Although that's correct, that every leader, even on this planet, we have different, you have leaders in Russia and America and, you know, Yemen and some, they're representatives of the Supreme Person, I've got it. Well, let's put it this way, they're meant to be representatives of the Supreme Person. And if they don't, there'll be chaos. And if they do and follow the guidelines, then they'll actually do their job properly. So that's another way to put it. They're meant to be representatives. As soon as one's in a high position, they must act as a representative. They're meant to be. And if they don't, there's chaos. So here we see, you know, in these verses here, that, you know, the sages are pointing out to Chitraketu. It's actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead who created this child, and then there's death, annihilation. That's actually all being done by the Personality of Godhead, and yet you're thinking you're doing it. But then if you consider, well, this is the arrangement, you know, these are the arrangements of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, should I be lamenting anything that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is doing? You know, he is a reservoir of all knowledge, intelligence, auspiciousness, he is all good. Why should I lament anything he does? As from one seed another seed is generated, O King, so from one body, the body of the father, through another body, the body of the mother, a third body is generated, the body of a son. As the elements of the material body are eternal, the living entity who appears through these material elements is also eternal. But report from Bhagavad Gita, we understand there are two energies, the superior energy and inferior energy. Inferior energy consists of the five gross and three subtle material elements. The living entity, who represents the superior energy, appears in different types of bodies through these elements by the manipulation of supervision of the material energy. Actually, both the material and spiritual energies, matter and spirit, exist eternally as potencies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The potent entity is the Supreme Person. Since the spiritual energy, the living being who is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, desires to enjoy this material world, the Lord gives him a chance to accept different types of material bodies and enjoy or suffer in different material conditions. Factually, the spiritual energy, the living entity who desires to enjoy material things, is manipulated by the Supreme Lord. The so-called father and mother have nothing to do with the living entity. As a result of his own choice in karma, the living entity takes different bodies through the agencies of so-called fathers and mothers. So here the sages are saying, you know, you're identifying that I've created this son. That's not actually what happened. What happened is the Lord has two energies, one the material energy, one the spiritual energy, and one of those little spirit souls desired to enjoy the material world, and the Lord made arrangements for him to come into a material body, and you became the father. Everything was done by the Lord. But you're thinking you've created it. In other words, you know, in the beginning they're asking, is this your son? You know, what's your relationship with this living entity? And when you start to look at it, you think, well, really, I've got this illusory, temporary relationship which didn't exist before, won't exist in the future, and it's temporary and somewhat illusory. Actually, the Lord's the father of this living entity. It's one of his part of his spiritual energy. And the Lord's actually put him into this body, you know, and I'm just like an agent, you know, and so is the mother. So really, you know, my relationship is really illusory. And the reality is actually that this is all the Lord's doing like that. So, you know, he's bringing him back to the reality of the situation. Divisions of generalization and specification, such as nationality and individuality, are the imaginations of persons who are not advanced in knowledge. So as we've heard, there are two energies ever existing as emanations from the eternal truth, the Supreme Lord. So, you know, what's interesting here also is that if you ask the material scientists, you know, because they have the Big Bang Theory and what's the other one, the chunk, you know, so there's, you know, and, you know, originally there was, you know, all the elements there, and then we got the chunk, and then we got the Big Bang. You've probably heard all this, yeah. So where did the original elements, material elements, come to form the big chunk? They were always there. That's their explanation, right? In other words, they accept them as eternal. If you say they're always there, they weren't created, they were just there. They're always there. They don't see a problem with that. What are they saying? They're eternal. So Krishna's saying, just as the material energy is always there, why can't you accept that the spirit soul is always there? Oh no, nothing can be eternal. Nothing can live forever. See? There's no logic in that, is it? They can accept the material elements. They're always there. You say, the soul lives forever. Oh, nothing can live forever. So, because the individual soul and the individual living entity has desired to act in forgetfulness of his original identity since time immemorial, he is accepting different positions in material bodies and being designated according to many divisions of nationality, community, species, society, species, and so on. So what's that second definition of pure devotional service? When one becomes free from all designations. Yeah. Rishikesh. Go on. Yeah. Yeah. Translation? What's the first sloka so you can look it up? Sarvapadi Vinir Muktam. Look that up. Okay. Now that is the other definition of devotional service, pure devotional service. That when can you perform devotional service? When you're free from all designations. Otherwise it doesn't begin. So one of the things that we try to do in order to help people to take up the path of devotional service, one of the things we try to do is to present this philosophy about you're a spirit soul, not the body, and that helps them become free from all the designations. Once they become free from their designations, they think, why am I serving my national interest instead of my eternal interest? You know, this temporary illusory interest instead of... So, did you find that? How did you go?
No.
No?
In the process.
Just, yep. While you're doing that, I'll just read on. Sukadeva Goswami continued, thus enlightened by the instructions of Narada and Angira, King Chitraketu became hopeful with knowledge. Wiping his shriveled face with his hand, the king began to speak. King Chitraketu said, you have both come here dressed like avadutas. So they're not appearing as Narada and Angira. They're somewhat a little bit disguised. Avadutas means they're sort of travelling like just a couple of crazy fellows that you wouldn't really recognise even as saintly. Liberated persons... just to cover your identities, but I see that of all men, you are the most elevated in awareness. You know everything as it is. Therefore, you are the greatest of all great personalities. Brahmanas who are exalted to the position of Vaishnavas, the most dear servants of Krishna, sometimes dress like madmen, just to benefit materialists like us, who are always attached to sense gratification, and just to dissipate our ignorance, these Vaishnavas wander on the surface of the globe according to their desire. O great souls, I have heard that among the great and perfect persons wandering the surface of the earth to instruct knowledge to people covered by ignorance is Sanat Kumara, Narada, Ribhu, Angira, Devala, Asita, Apantaratma, Vyasadev, Markandeya, Gautama, Vasistha, Bhagavan Parashuram, Kapila, Sukadev, Devasa, Yajnavalkya, Jatukana, and Uruni. Others are Ramasha, Chavan, Dattatreya, Ashuri, Patanjali, the great sage Dormya, who is like the head of the Vedas, the sage Panchashika, Haranyanava, Kaushala, Sutadev, and Ritivaj. You must certainly be among them. So he's understanding that these are great sages. They must be in this list. Now, in the purport here, he describes that The acharyas mentioned in this, they're described in the Mahabharata. So, Where's yours in the car? While we're in this purport, how'd you go? Did you get that? No? Was it? Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
Because you read it in a loud voice.
The translation.
Yeah, translation.
Bhakti or devotional service means in Bhakti or devotional service means engaging all our senses in the service of the Lord, Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Master of all senses. When the spirit soul renders service unto the Supreme, there are two side effects. One is freed from all material designations, and one's senses are purified simply by being employed in the service of the Lord.
Yeah, very nice translation. You notice there are a couple of different translations to that. I really like that one. Because in that one, it emphasizes, the way Prabhupada has put it, that you just do the devotional service, it will purify you and it will free you from the designations. In other translations, it's put more like this. You become free from designations, then you can engage in pure devotional service. So, in that sense, it's saying, here, when you put the two together, it means don't wait for anything. Engage in devotional service and it will purify you and you'll gradually become free from designations. And when you're completely free from designations, then you can engage in pure devotional service. So you put them together, it's like that. As soon as you have any designation, I'm Australian, I'm Hindu, you know. Therefore, a lot of people who, you know, come to the temple, to visit the temple, they come as Hindus. So that bars them from pure devotional service, allows them to engage in some agyata sukriti, little bhakti, but it actually holds them back. They have to go when they're, I'm not a Hindu, I'm not an Australian, I'm not this, I'm not that. As that purification kicks in, they become more eligible to engage in higher levels of devotional service. Thanks, Vasudev. So in this purport here is describing Panchasika. Now, Panchasika is a sage. And there's also Panchasika in the sense that one who is liberated from the conceptions of Anamaya, Pranamaya, Manamaya, Vijnanamaya and Anandamaya, and who is perfectly aware of the subtle coverings of the soul is called Panchasika. Now, in the statements in the Mahabharata, an acharya named Panchasika took birth in the family of Maharaj Janaka, the ruler of Mithila. The Sankhya philosophers, as we know, many Sankhya philosophers are sometimes impersonalists. They accept Panchasika Acharya as one of them. Now, note in this purport that Panchasika means one who is liberated from the five conceptions, even Anandamaya. And that, to me, suggests the impersonalist Sankhya line, not the Vaishnava line. Because Anamaya means the first stage of a living entity where Everything is centered around what they eat. Little babies. You know, is what goes in the mouth. That's all I'm concerned with. Pranamaya means, as the child develops, they understand, oh, I'm alive. You know, I'm a living entity. I can do things. I can run around and kick things and break things and scream and yell like that. And play and do some constructive things as well. And Manamaya, they understand, oh, I've got this great mental facility as well. I can do all sorts of things with the mind. I can think and create different ideas and like that. Sometimes there's also Jnanamaya. Vijnanamaya, one realizes that one is a spirit soul. Anandamaya means that one realizes transcendental bliss. Now, the impersonalists sometimes engage in devotional service and then reject it. Right? So therefore, you know, here it's saying liberated from the conception of Anandamaya would tend to suggest the impersonalists. But actually in the devotional line, when you get to Anandamaya, it's actually considered the stage of perfection which we don't reject. And Anandamaya means that we're actually engaged in the blissful process of devotional service, tasting rasa. Right, so just note that.
Also, when you say Anandamaya for impersonalists,
it's like they'll reject that at some stage.
They think
that they have to give up that sense of, enjoying any of the, for instance, devotional activities or worship or what have you that they're doing, which is helping them on the path of liberation, personal liberation. Eventually, they'll have to give up all of that. Devotees consider that the actual stage of perfection which they accept. So therefore, just bear that in mind. So it appears that this Pancha Sikara, you know, there was some maybe impersonal teaching. But, you know, it's mentioned here that Prabhupada says that, sure, it's this purport or the previous purport. He says, therefore, all the Brahmanas listed here, being devotees, travel all over the world to awaken Krishna consciousness in the hearts of such foolish materialists. All right? Now, in this list, you'll see people like, you know, Parashuram, you know, Gautama. I mean, Gautama was one of the, you know, he taught one of the six philosophies, which was, I think, the one he taught was, what was that? What?
Nyaya.
So, which is not particularly devotional. It's, you know, it's really got nothing to do with devotional service. Here, Gautama, of course, is represented as a devotee, and yet the philosophy he taught was nyaya, you know, logic. But although many of these personalities, even here we see Panchashika, who taught these somewhat philosophies devoid of devotional service, doesn't mean that they're not devotees. But they're helping people on some level, you know, elevate. Just like Buddha, he's the supreme person of God, you know, Shaktivesh Avatar. But he taught, you know, some illusory philosophy that was against the Vedas. That doesn't mean he's not a devotee of the Lord. So here they're all listed as devotees. But that doesn't mean that all these people are teaching devotional service. I don't take it that way. Mm. Right. So he's saying, you know, that you must be against it. Because you are great personalities, You can give me real knowledge. I am as foolish as a village animal, like a pig or dog, because I emerge in the darkness of ignorance. Therefore, please ignite the torch of knowledge to save me. Again, very important verse. Tasmagurum prapajita jigashu shreya uttamam. You know, one must submit oneself to one of these great personalities to receive knowledge. That's actually the highest goal of life. The guru should not be approached for material benefits. That's what Chitraketu did originally. He approached Angira, who was in that list. This is not the way to approach the guru. That'd be Gautam. One should approach the guru to understand the transcendental science of spiritual life. See, so that was the mistake that Chitraketu made. And therefore, he was ineligible at that point to actually get the transcendental knowledge. Even though the spiritual master, the same spiritual master who's instructing him now, was there, the instruction didn't come because he wanted material benefit.
Prabhu, but many times you also read that if you have material desires, rather than ask the demigods, you can ask the Supreme Lord himself.
If you have material desires,
rather than ask demigods, you ask the Supreme Lord, he'll give it in a way that will purify you.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's what Chitraketu did.
That's what he did.
So he was purified in that process. So Krishna gave it in such a way that
purified. That's right. So when one approaches Krishna, even for material desires, Krishna will act in such a way that eventually they'll not ask for that material desires again. They'll become purified and they'll also come to the point where they'll want transcendental knowledge. So Krishna, therefore, go to Krishna even for material desires. In the Srimad Bhagavatam in Canto 10, Chapter 20, I think it is, a description of autumn, where it has the beautiful descriptions of autumn, and sometimes then it describes the waterfalls and like that in the rainy season, that it describes that waterfalls sometimes run and sometimes they don't. And Prabhupada says that that is compared to devotees of the Lord, that sometimes they'll speak transcendental knowledge and sometimes they don't, according to their own desire. They're not robots, you know. Nor are they obliged. According to their sweet will, a devotee will give transcendental knowledge or not. And sometimes people come from material. One time someone came to Prabhupada's room and Prabhupada spoke to him for like an hour. Oh, they talked about, Prabhupada, yes, I still got all my teeth, I'm, 80 something, and talked about this, and you've been to here, this place? Yes, I went there, One of his disciples asked him, afterwards, Prabhupada, you never spoke any transcendental knowledge. You said he didn't ask me. And we know how keen Prabhupada was to take any opportunity to speak the Gita. But it's a good lesson for devotees, Don't just force things down. Transcendental knowledge, yeah, we're preachers, but, if they're not asking, sometimes just, keep a civil relationship. They'll get some yadas and credit, some benefit. If they just like you, they'll get some benefit. So, Angira said, my dear king, when you desired to have a son, I approached you. Indeed, I am the same Angira Rishi who gave you this son. As for this Rishi, he is the great sage Narada, the direct son of Lord Brahma. Of course, if Angira had appeared in his original form, Chitraketu may have caused some offence or got angry at him. My dear king, you are an advanced devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. To be absorbed in lamentation for the loss of something material is unsuitable for a person like you. Therefore, we have both come to relieve you from this false lamentation, which is due to your being merged in the darkness of ignorance. For those who advance in spiritual knowledge to be affected by material loss and gain is not at all desirable. And now we get to the point where, you know, he's come to his senses. And now they're reminding him. Actually, he's actually, you know, an advanced devotee who's sort of lost that consciousness. And for him to be so affected by loss and gain is not at all desirable on that path of spiritual life. So Mahapurusha, advanced devotees of the Supreme Lord. Prabhupada mentions, what is the platform of devotee? A devotee always aspires to engage in the service of advanced devotees. He sings that song by Narottam Das Thakur. Tandila Chalana Sevi Bhakti Sanivas Janami Janami Hae Abhilas. A devotee should always aspire to live in the association of advanced devotees and engage in the service of the Lord through the parampara system. One should serve the mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu through the instructions of the great Goswamis of Vrindavan. This is called Tandara Charana Sevi. While serving the lotus feet of the Goswamis, one should live in the association of devotees, Bhakta Sannivas. This is the business of a devotee. A devotee should not aspire for material profit or lament for material loss. So there, that sums up the right way for a devotee to live. That is the sum and substance of a devotee's entire life, aspirations and everything they do, right there in that song. Prabhupada quotes that a lot in his lecture. And what should a devotee not do? Aspire for material profit or lament for material loss. So when Angira Rishi and Narada saw that Maharaj Chitraketu, an advanced devotee, had fallen into the darkness of ignorance and was lamenting for the material body of his son, by their causeless mercy they came to advise him so that he could be safe from this ignorance. Another significant word, Brahmanya. The Supreme Lord is sometimes addressed by the prayer Namo Brahmanya Devaya, which offers obeisances to the Lord because he is served by the devotees. Therefore, this verse states, Brahmanyo Bhagavad Bhakto Nivasaratam Mahasi. This is the symptom of an advanced devotee. They're always serving the Lord. Brahma Bhutta Prasanatma, for a devotee and an advanced self-realized soul, there is no cause for material jubilation or lamentation. He is always transcendental to conditioned life. Therefore, Prabhupada, whenever he would see a devotee who was morose, he would say, go in the closet. Go in the closet. If a devotee is morose, go in the closet. It's just not acceptable. It's just, you know, it's not part of our process. You know, there's no room for devotees to be morose. It's not part of our, you know. If you're morose, you better go in the closet because it's just not part of what we do. You do that by yourself independently, but don't do it in the association. Yeah. When I first came to your home, I could have given you the supreme transcendental knowledge. But when I saw that your mind was absorbed in material things, I gave you only a son who caused you jubilation and lamentation. My dear king, now you are actually experiencing the misery of a person who has sons and daughters. O king, owner of the state of Surasena, one's wife, his house, the opulence of his kingdom, and his various other opulences and objects of sense perception are all the same in that they are temporary. One's kingdom, military power, treasury, servants, ministers, friends and relatives are all causes of fear, illusion, lamentation and distress. They are like a Gandhava Nagara, a non-existent palace that one imagines to exist in the forest. So, of course, the forest is a very dangerous place to be. But if you imagine that you're in a Gandhava Nagara, you're still in that dangerous forest, but you're really in illusion, so you're just going to suffer. Because they are impermanent, they are no better than illusions, dreams and mental concoctions. So, whatever we have in this world, we have to give up, except another situation. Of course, the next situation may be more unfavourable. And even if it is favourable, we'll have to give it up anyway. So, a sane man should be perfectly aware of these things, that these things will never be able to give him happiness. One must be situated in his spiritual identity and eternally serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead as a devotee. Angira Rishi Narada gave this instruction to Maharaj Chitraketan. That's the solution. I'm a spirit soul. I have an eternal relationship with Krishna. None or something. Come to reality. Try and enjoy the material world. Fear, illusion, disappointment. These visible objects like wife, children and property are like dreams and mental concoctions. Actually, what we see has no permanent existence. It is sometimes seen and sometimes not. Only because of our past actions do we create such mental concoctions, and because of these concoctions we perform further activities. So again, you know, this analogy of the dream is given. It's like at night one dreams of tigers and snakes, and while dreaming he actually sees them, but as soon as the dream is broken they no longer exist. Similarly, the material world is a creation of our mental concoction. So we actually see our relatives. Oh, there's my, you know, relatives, there's my friend. We see them, but then life finishes. Where are they? You know, where are our relatives and that from a previous life? Where, you know, we're not there. Now, here, the interesting thing is that it all centres around mental concoctions. So that's what the main thing is drawing here. So we've understand the illusion and the suffering in material existence. But what's the centre of it? What's creating it? The mind. So he says, we come to this material world to enjoy material resources, and by mental concoction we discover many objects of enjoyment because our minds are absorbed in material things. This is why we receive various bodies. According to our mental concoctions, we work in various ways, desiring various achievements. And by nature and the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we get the advantages we desire. Thus, we become more and more involved with material concoctions. This is the reason for our suffering in the material world. By one kind of activity we create another, and they're all products of our mental concoctions. Some people walk really heavy, don't they? It's like a baby elephant. Is it? Like when I walk, is it?
And the family suffering. And then we said that among the devotees, we tend to be very heavy.
Yeah.
We should be more considerate.
Yeah.
We know all this reality, but how would we tell them when they are suffering with that? I mean, okay, we know all this, but that's not the way we preach to them.
Yeah, look.
A person who's suffering and that...
we preach in a similar way that they're preaching here. But here, you know, there's a specific difference in that Chitraketu has really fallen down. What we were discussing last time is that, say, for instance, with Arjun, he lost his son. His lamentation, if you read that, when I read how Arjun lamented, it made me cry. His suffering, it made me cry just to read that, how sad he was in the Mahabharata. You know, one time Prabhupada was in a lecture, and at the end someone wanted to challenge the Bhagavad Gita by attacking Arjun. He says, you know, why, after hearing this transcendental knowledge and the Gita, the one still acts ridiculously? Prabhupada says, what is that? Who is that at? Arjun. He's heard the Bhagavad Gita, and then his son dies, and he laments, he cries like an ordinary materialist. And then Prabhupada become quite angry, although he didn't show it. And he, Prabhupada, he gradually spoke a little bit about the Bhagavad Gita, and then he was saying that, you know, why are you speaking ridiculously? And gradually, as this man, kept speaking, Prabhupada was able to point out contradictions in everything he said, and very strongly and continually said, you know, that you are speaking ridiculously. And of course the whole audience ended up laughing at this person. So Prabhupada really, you know, put him in his place. But Prabhupada, during that conversation, he said, the difference is that Arjun was engaged in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as his eternal devotee. It's natural for a devotee to lament and feel compassionate for, you know, when their children, family or friends undergo, you know, death or suffering. It's natural. Because devotees, you know, their hearts are very soft and loving. Why would they not, you know, feel sadness for someone that they love who's now just disappeared out of their life? You know, or made such a sacrifice on their behalf. You know, their hearts are soft, compassionate, loving, filled with all qualities. Why would they not lament? But when a devotee laments, they don't lose the understanding that they're the eternal servant of Krishna and that they have a service to do. They very quickly gain their composure, and again take up that service. You do not see that with the materialists. In the beginning, they have no concept of their eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If something bad happens, they begin to accuse God. You know, I curse you, I challenge you, you know, I will never worship you, even if you do exist. So many things. I deny your existence. I never want to, you know, like that. And then afterwards, you know, they remain deeply in that state of lamentation, literally for the duration of their life. They never recover. The duration of their life. Oh, someone loses, you know, one of their children, you know, someone, a loved one, they never recover. Their whole lives, you know, they lament for the duration of life. So a devotee, because they're on the platform of transcendental knowledge, that, you know, doesn't mean they don't have feelings and natural responses as every other person. So they have those, and then, you know, they, you know, quickly, because of their transcendental knowledge and the assistance of association, they gain their composure and they again take up that service of the Lord, and they realise the eternal situation of the situation, of what's happened. Oh, my son has died. He's an eternal spirit soul. He's with Krishna. He died in the battlefield fighting for Krishna. Why am I lamenting for him? I would like to see him. I will see him again because I'm also eternal. So gradually, you know, these understandings are there. So that lamentation is, you know, dissipates because they have a long-term spiritual vision and spiritual understanding. Therefore, my point is that when devotees go through significant difficulty, it's actually natural for devotees to, you know, feel sympathy and compassion and to try to help them and to be concerned for them. That's natural. You know, we shouldn't just, you know, have some artificial thing that, oh, I'm not going to show any emotion. You know, they're going through some suffering. It's all part of some dreamlike existence they're in. I'm not joining in with that illusion like that. That's my point. But if a devotee, due to the circumstances, and they don't have the spiritual strength to recover their spiritual composure, then devotees, given a little time and in the right way, may have to speak to them philosophically with a little more oomph, a little bit more force to help them to come back to that spiritual, you know, don't fall away. Like that. So they may have to give them a little jolt in a loving way to help them.
No, I'm still about that, the family I was talking about, the kids saying that Krishna has taken our father away and so we don't want to go towards Krishna.
Yeah.
Moving away.
Mm.
So, I mean, how would you deal with that? That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
Angira at that time when Chitaketu was in that level, he did not give him that spiritual knowledge. He just tried to just now I can't.
Sometimes.
So that these people are in that state now.
Sometimes, if you know, then you know, if you can't give the transcendental knowledge, give some prasadam.
That's all. That's
it. Something. You see, like with the devotee who delivered Jamunacharya, who fell down from an elevated position of spiritual consciousness to a royal enjoyer of sense gratification. And what did that devotee used to come, and every day, what was he doing? He's just giving this special like spinach to the cook.
Yeah.
And he was eating. And he did that for months. Yes. Very quiet walking. Well done. But he did that for a long time. He just, you know, showed him that kindness. And then he just sort of disappeared. Oh, where's the spinach? So you give him prasadam, and then maybe one day you stop giving prasadam. They call you up. Oh, we were enjoying that prasadam so much. Oh, yes, I'll come around. Maybe I could have a little chat with you this time. Yes, please do. So, you know, it just carefully, that's all. You know, we try not to give up on people, but we also don't bash them over the head with the Gita. The living entity in the bodily conception of life is absorbed in the body, which is a combination of the physical elements, the five senses for gathering knowledge and the five senses of actions, along with the mind. Through the mind, the living entity suffers three kinds of tribulation, adibhautika, adidevika and adiatmika. Therefore, this body is a source of all miseries. And that's stated also in the Bhagavad Gita. Is that the 14th chapter, I think? You know, it's actually through the mind that the living entity suffers and enjoys. You know, the modes of material nature are there, but, you know, it's the mind that's causing the living entity the suffering or enjoyment. It's all a mental concoction.
Is it okay to lament then?
No. Devotees don't lament, hanker or lament. Devotees don't hanker or lament. But that's different from, you know, having loving sentiments, you know, with devotees and you know, when there's, you know, compassion, you know, friendship and love, and that the object of that love or compassion is in a very difficult position, then, you know, you know, it affects those loving sentiments. That's a different sort of a thing. That's on the basis of transcendental relationships with devotees rather than lamenting for material things that have been lost or hankering for material things that you want to gain. Right? So there's a difference between our emotions being applied towards transcendental persons and objectives, and our emotions being applied to material things. When our emotions are being applied to material things, it's hankering and lamenting. But when our emotions are being applied to devotional service, to Krishna and the devotees, it's a different platform. So, you know, in other words, some lamentation that a devotee is undergoing extreme difficulty is not a material thing. No. Unless we're lamenting for their body, then that's a different thing. You know, it should be, you know, it's related to the soul. Yes, but even that temporary lamentation or you know, sadness of a devotee in relationship to other devotees should be on the transcendental platform, related to the soul and understanding, you know, the illusory nature of the bodily condition. Prabhupada gives some examples here how the whole material creation is based on mental concoction. Oh, Mahatma. Hare Krishna, nice to see you. Thank you. Wonderful service. His wife, you know, she gives a little packages of tulsi, which we offered her. She's such a nice devotee. She's such a transcendental person. She's not on the bodily platform. She doesn't, no lamenting, hankering. You know, she's just fixing her service. You know, very nice devotee. What's her name again? Raja. Raja something. The mind sometimes induces us to think that if we purchase an automobile, we can enjoy physical elements. So we see how the mind's thinking, oh, I've got to get that Lamborghini. Now, what is the car? Prabhupada's saying, it's earth, water, air, fire, combined in forms of iron, plastic, petrol, and so on. So really we're saying, oh, I want that earth, water, fire, air, you know, and enjoy it with the different senses of the body. Another way of saying that is I want that nice red car. So, working with the five material elements, as well as with our five knowledge-gathering senses, like eyes, ears, tongue, and our five active senses, hands and legs, we become involved in the material condition. So we actually get the car, we're driving it, we're working for it. Thus we're subjected to the tribulations known as adhyatmika, adhidevika, adhibhautika. The mind is the centre because the mind creates all these things. As soon as a material object is struck, however, the mind is affected and we suffer. For example, with the material elements, the working senses and the knowledge-gathering senses, we create a very nice car, and when the car is accidentally smashed in a collision, the mind suffers. And through the mind, the living entity suffers. Yeah. Now, adhibhautika, adhidevika, and adhyatmika. Adhidevika, of course, is conditions created by the demigods. It's like we're having floods in Victoria. So one man was driving in his car, he was about 84 years old, tried to cross the causeway, got swept away into the dam, now he's dead. So that's adhidevika. The demigods created conditions. As we heard, you know, adhibhautika, other living entities. Sometimes people run into a kangaroo in their car, smash up the car. And sometimes the kangaroos have gone through the windscreen. Yeah, and it was not funny because they literally kicked the people to death. Yeah. Adhyatmika. Basically, you know, everything affects the mind and the body of the living entity. So the fact is, the living entity, while concocting with the mind, creates the material condition. And because matter is destructible, through the material condition, the living entity suffers. Otherwise, the living entity is detached from all material conditions. When one comes to Brahman platform, the spiritual platform, fully understanding that he is a spirit soul, he is no longer affected by lamentation or hankering. Brahma, 1854, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Asochiti Nakanchati. One who is thus transcendentally situated at once realizes the Supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments nor desires to have anything. It's one of the things when I was in the first couple of days of the meningitis, I had the severe headaches. And one of the things that I did was, you know, I laid there and I meditated that I'm actually not this body. So, you know, I'm actually a spirit soul. So all this, although I can feel the pain and everything, and but still, ultimately, as a spirit soul, I'm not actually affected, but somehow because I'm associated with this body, you know, I'm associating with the pain. But because I know I'm a spirit soul, there was a sense of transcendental peace, you know, that, okay, this is not really affecting me. Nothing can really touch me. And I was actually meditating like that. And I found that to be very helpful. Yeah, you know. Because what it did was it took my mind, it helped to take my mind from the suffering, and it took it away to a transcendental place, you know. And the more I was able to just absorb like that, it just, although the pain is there, you don't think about it, you know, because you've got somewhere else to go and take it. For a materialist, they can't do that. They've just got the body. Their mind has to stay there. There's nowhere else to go. See? So for a devotee, we can actually take something. And the same, you know, one of the things, when I was able to just lay down in the lounge room, I was in a lot of pain, but, you know, they have that series, there's about 8 tapes with Prabhupada, remembering Prabhupada. Shows you Prabhupada from the very beginning of ISKCON right through to the end, and all the major milestones and all the movies that they ever made. And as you go through it, all the devotees, you know, like what's his name? The GBC used to be here, came from America. The GBC that used to be here from America that came over with Prabhupada. But, you know, anyway, it showed all the different devotees, Brahmananda and some, you know, who are all part of the Rath Yatra, opening the temples and everything like that with Prabhupada. And they told all the different stories of the main thing that Prabhupada was thinking about and doing and talking about, you know, the real essence of what was happening there and what Prabhupada was, why he was doing what he was doing and going where he was going like that. It was really interesting. What was I going to say there? That, I watched the entire series and I went through it a couple of times. I mean, it took me days and days to go through it. But there was 2 things I could do. I could chant and I could watch those DVDs. I could only lie there. Couldn't get up. I could just lie there. That was it. The Srimurti was hand feeding me at that stage. I couldn't feed myself, couldn't do anything. And I was in pain from head to toe. But I watched those DVDs and it took me to a different place. And hours would go by and it takes your mind to a different place. And then gradually as I was able to sit up, then, you know, I put a lot more attention into my chanting, which I was able to do a little bit more strength. And again, you know, your mind just goes to that chanting, you know, for hours and hours. Otherwise, when that's not there and you just, the mind goes to the body, the suffering is so much more intense at that. So, you know, I was getting some, you know, Krishna was helping me to get some really nice, you know, realizations just on a really fundamental platform, you know, taking me back to the basics.
How did you get this?
Well, as far as I understand, that it is transferred. I was doing a lot of home programs just before Balaram's appearance day. Mostly, you know, like devotees, but they have a lot of guests, families, and when, you know, someone has poor hygiene, especially, say, women with babies, and they become involved in the food preparation or serving, then somehow during that, you know, it was that I got the meningitis. That's how, you know, so it's made me...
So it's transmitted by food?
Yeah, it's one of the ways. It's one of the, it's probably the way that I got it, you know, but it is like that, some poor hygiene and, you know, transferred. And, you know, so it's made me very, very cautious about, you know, when I attend even devotees' programs, if I see that, you know, because quite often you get the relatives and they say, oh, I want to help, and they just let them do all sorts of things. And then they're looking after their baby and doing that, and the baby's crying, and, you know, and they put the babies on the bench and all sorts of things. You know, I've now developed a very strict policy that I won't eat. Like that. So, you know, one of the things I got from that, you know, the hard way, is that I'm going to be extremely particular where I will and not eat. And in most cases, I'm just going to take my own bottle of water and just have a little fruit. And in most cases, I won't be eating unless I really know the people and I understand that, you know, that it's just devotees with high standards of cooked, and then I won't be eating. So that's one of the things that I've done. You know, the other thing, of course, is that... you know,
the other person in the school of your daughter who got it, she was also contacted by food.
Who got it?
You said that somebody...
No one else had it.
No, some lady in your daughter's school, she got it and she died.
That's right, yeah. The headmistress,
we don't know
how she got it. But that's, you know, I have spoken to different doctors. When when I saw the doctor for the first time, and I said, you know, it's... really freaky thing that I got this. He said, no, it's out there. It's actually not that uncommon. So, you know, I was thinking, boy, what a, you know, I had it, my mother told me I had it when I was a baby, just a couple of years old, and they actually had to, they do a whole thing where they drain your spinal thing and replace it with, you know, so, but now the headmistress of my daughter's school was saying she had a friend and she got the meningitis and within 3 hours she died, you know. And my mother's person who does a bit of home care, he had a friend of his who got the meningitis, and although he lived, he never recovered his bodily functions or his mental capacities like that. So, you know.
So it transfers to food or any other thing?
Well, it's not just food, but, you know, someone virus. There's two forms. One is a virus form, and one is a bacterial form. I got the virus form, which is actually considered not as severe as the bacteria one, because the bacteria one has a greater ability to literally eat away at your brain. Yeah. And because it travels up your spine and goes all the way to your brain, and it shuts down the different menses or something, menses that, you know, are there. Yeah. And it shuts down your immune system and your nervous system, and just shuts down your whole body. Basically, everything stops working. And but, you know, the doctors that I've spoken to, they say it's Because I was thinking, whoa, how unusual. They say it's actually common. It's out there, and therefore, it is sort of transferred, through some sort of bodily, fluid or secretion, and that lack of hygiene, that virus or the bacteria form, are then transferred to the person. So, the only thing I was doing in those couple of days before that was I was going to home programs, and I did notice that even with devotee programs, that they would have relatives and friends just coming in and out, cooking and doing things with the kids, and that's the most likely. You can get it just going through a mall. You can just go through a mall and sort of, people have, put their hands, infected something, and you touch that, and then you might, sort of eat something, put your fingers in your mouth. It's also that easy. I was watching a documentary on television where, there's a common myth that if you drop food on the ground, there's a 5-second rule or something. If you pick it up before 5 seconds and eat it, then it's okay. Germs haven't really affected. But actually, there was a documentary in Current Affairs, and the scientists proved that to be completely wrong. That within less than a second, if food touches the ground or contaminated place, within less than a second, hundreds of germs or viruses enter that food immediately. Less than a second. So, it doesn't really take much.
The children, most of the time, children take everything from the ground and
things like that. That's right, So,
as a bacteria, it is contagious.
What's
virus,
that?
The
virus that I have.
As a virus, it's not contagious. But
the bacteria is worse and more contagious. The virus form tends to hit your body, and it tends to go very quickly. Therefore, they don't give you any treatment for it. If you get to the hospital and they do the lumbar puncture and all that, which I had, within 48 hours or less, they may be able to identify the virus and give you something. They may, still not necessarily. The bacterial one, they give you antibiotics, but you're in a lot of trouble. So because, I was so ill in that first couple of days, I didn't think that I would survive getting from my bedroom to the ambulance. I was that ill. I couldn't imagine that I would actually possibly be able to just go from there to the ambulance, let alone the trip to the hospital, and then waiting in the hospital halls until they did something, and then them sticking needles. So it took me 2 days to get to the doctor because I just couldn't move for the amount
of...
What's
the first symptom?
You get the stiffness of the neck. And the other thing I found was that although usually, I'm out in the cold and what have you, and I'm sort of generally rugged up, I noticed that I started getting the stiffness in the neck, the headaches, I started to lose my strength, and the cold just... I just couldn't protect myself from the cold, and it wasn't even that cold, but it was like just... I had no immune system to it, There was no protection in my body. It was like the usual just... So, then the headache started, and then a lot of pain in the body, but the stiffness in the neck is usually quite a significant thing. But, that virus tends to go through your body quite quickly, and then it just shuts down everything. And if you survive that, then you just got to kickstart your body, which I'm sort of still trying to do, even after, 3 weeks, nearly a month, probably about 60%. I still get a lot of pain on a daily basis, and very little strength. The one good thing is I've got a big appetite, which is a sign, a good sign. I've got a massive appetite, even better than before I was ill. I just like, and yet I missed lunch today. I was half an hour late and there was no lunch. And I was looking forward to a big lunch because I got this big appetite. It's not good for me, but there was nothing there.
It's a good sign. Should
make that, that's right, yeah. Because in the first days, Sri Mary was just feeding me. I was having a little bit of soup and a little bit of stewed apple, a few teaspoons, and that's all she could give me. And that's all I could eat. I couldn't even put it in my own mouth. And I was like a skeleton. I lost everything. In the last week or so, I put on so much weight and I still look pretty thin. But you know, I did get a lot of realizations, and I also, you know, made some very strict rules of, you know, taking prasad at people's homes. And the other thing is that I'm much more selective as to whose ceremonies I'm doing. Because every time you do a ceremony, you know, as Prabhupada mentions in the 8th canto, you accept karma. And so, but, you know, the difference is that, so for instance, for initiation, a guru accepts karma. When you perform a ceremony, you accept some karma. But the ceremony that I always do is a sankirtan ceremony. In other words, when I sit people down to do a mundan, a namkarana, I sit them down that I'm going to teach you to chant Hare Krishna. I don't accept karma for that, and you're burning. So I'm going to teach you the importance of Bhagavad Gita. I'm going to teach you the value of worshipping Krishna. Chant Krishna's name. You chant 1,000 names of Vishnu, which most people appreciate, you get the same benefit by one Ram. You chant three Rams, you get the same benefit by one Krishna. And people immediately think, oh, like that, they like to chant. So I teach them the value of chanting Hare Krishna, the importance of the Gita, and the importance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And a lot of people, you know, tend to respond to that. And therefore, I'm not actually doing a ritual in the sense that an ordinary Brahmana would do. I'm actually preaching Sankirtan. So there's definitely some karma. And the other thing which I've tightened up is my chanting of japa. I've made a concerted effort to just increase the quality and the, you know, prayer within my chanting in order to be able to, you know, do the service. And I'm also, because of my age and everything, I'm actually reducing the quantity of service and going more for the quality. So therefore, I didn't book anything for today because I did a wedding on Wednesday. I've got a couple of ceremonies tomorrow. That's enough. I have so many orders. But I just said no. Today, that's enough. Quality chanting. So at home today, instead of coming to the temple and doing three ceremonies, I just read these chapters to make sure I have a little bit more quality in the back of that. So you know, I've made a lot of very important resolves for the quality of my devotional service, to give me some protection so that I can continue without accepting karma, being a little bit more selective. I had some people who go to a Durga temple who wanted me to do a ceremony. They wanted me to do a ceremony at a particular time, a particular day. Now, I said I couldn't do that because I wasn't well, and I couldn't do that day. They suggested another day. I said, I can't do that day as well. And I gave them some days. And I explained to them that above everything is the holy name and everything like that. They didn't respond at all. And I understood that they had no faith whatsoever. They were really just going to put their faith in some material time, and they were just full on worship Durga, no allegiance to Krishna. So I'm quite happy not to do that. As you say, I didn't see a real good opportunity to preach, and I'm not there to do just rituals like that. So I just, you know, they said, oh, we'll go somewhere else. I said, fine. So, you know, I'm tightening up like that, so that I'm more selective with that. So, you know, I got a lot of, you know, these things don't happen. You know, whatever happens to a devotee, we don't take as a cause of lamentation, but we see that Krishna is directing us towards a better way of serving him. And, you know, that's the way I've taken the whole thing. So we only have two or three verses to go. We'll just finish that up and then we'll conclude for today. But look, thank you for your, you know, taking interest in my pitiful, miserable life of suffering.
Prabhu, I have one question. I don't know whether it's appropriate or not. Yeah. I do know whoever has done some rituals, they came to Krishna consciousness and became good devotees, whoever you have done.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And, you know, that's why I'm continuing.
How can we differentiate, like, whom to do and whom not to do like that?
Well, as I said, when I spoke to these, you know, Nelly, every time I do a booking, I have a little discussion with the people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just test the waters and I explain what I'm going to do, a little kirtan,
mm-hmm.
read the Gita.
Mm-hmm.
And I can sense, you know, when people come that way a little bit, you know, and show a little respect for that, you can tell straight away.
Mm-hmm.
When people have no interest in that at all, look, we just want this time. We didn't even care about a puja, just cut the hair at this time. That's a whole different ball game. Yeah, like that. I mean, so I don't care whether they worship Sai Baba, whether they worship Durga, or whether they're complete atheists, or whether they're Buddhists. If they show respect that, yes, you're going to do this chanting in the Gita, and you're telling me that it has great spiritual potency, then yes, please come and do that. Then I will do that. Yeah. There's no other consideration than that.
Sometimes Indian families are very, you know, the Western people, like, at least to some degree it's okay.
Yeah.
But Indians, if they act funny, you can't deal with it.
Yeah.
It's better to, you know,
yeah.
Not to do it.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Well, you know, Burujan Prabhu, when Nisringa Kavacha was here, I spoke to Nisringa Kavacha. Nisringa Kavacha, he said to me, Burujan Prabhu just said straight out, if they're not full-time devotees, don't do a ceremony at all.
Mm.
See, that's how. When I said to my spiritual master that I'm doing these ceremonies, he said to me, oh, you'll be well fed then.
Sorry?
You'll be well fed then.
You'll be
well fed. Yeah. So, you know, because I'm a preacher, and that's my foremost goal when I do these ceremonies, is to give this transcendental knowledge in a little nutshell, and they're chanting, get them chanting. And as you were saying, there are many people who are now even initiated.
Yeah, practicing very nicely.
Yeah, full-time devotees, full-time doing service, who I've just done a hair cutting, a housewarming, a new baby, and they were just completely off the planet with, you know, worship of demigods and bogus gurus and what have you. So, you know, it's to put those people back on the path of devotional service, and there's a little bit of suffering that you have to undergo You know, I don't know whether I just want to. What's that?
Mind the suffering then, because it's devotional service. It's part of preaching.
It is part of preaching.
Why the suffering?
Yeah, is because to stop people from doing it just for respect or material gain.
Yeah, but people are doing it with the proper motivation of suffering.
No, if even the people who are doing with the proper motive, you know, if you look at the devotees who, you know, the gurus who are initiating, and they suffer, they have the proper motive, but still there's going to be some suffering like that. Prabhupada said his spiritual master left this world early because of, you know, accepting, you know, the sinful reactions of some disciples who were, you know, somewhat insincere or what have you. He had to suffer for that, therefore he left this world early. It's not a quality, you know, it's a checks and balances that, you know, like one time a taxi driver came here, I did a ceremony for him. He was very, very respectful. But at the end he said, I want to do this as well. And I said to him, if you do this, you think you're going to gain some money, but you will have to accept karma for everyone that you do that. And he said, oh, I'll not do it. See? So, you know, it's a Krishna's system that even if you're very sincere, still according to your spiritual potency, therefore you see gurus. Prabhupada said to Jayavataka Maharaj, you can accept 10,000 disciples. And you see other gurus, they won't accept one disciple, you know. And then some gurus will accept a couple of dozen or a hundred. Some gurus will get one of the disciples to initiate because they don't think they, you know, but they're sincere. So, you know, it's not something to be taken lightly.
Taking
so many disciples, that's exactly right. Yeah. So it's not a matter of, no one can imitate Prabhupada. Every devotee is on a certain level, they have a certain level of spiritual potency, and they can't imitate someone on a higher level, their potency. No one can do what Prabhupada did. No matter how sincere they are, they cannot imitate what Prabhupada did. He was on such a high level of spiritual potency, so dear to the Lord, you know. So so therefore, sometimes Krishna lets you know. Ganga, you know, you have a certain limit. You be careful going above that, because, you know, I have my checks and balances. For your own, you know, ability, you can't go above your level. You can do so much and that's it. And be, you know, and you be careful to stay within the realms of your actual spiritual situation and don't go above that. So, you know, it keeps you firmly situated, you know, in humility. And it helps to push you that, yes, so if I want to continue and expand the service, I actually have to become a more qualified devotee. It's not a matter of accepting more orders, it's a matter of becoming a more qualified devotee. Like that. So, these are some of the realizations that we got. But let's just, any more questions? Thank you for your interest. Let's just finish these couple of verses here. Therefore, O King Chitraketu, carefully consider the position of the Atma. In other words, try to understand who you are, whether body, mind, or soul. So he's explained how the body, and he's explained how the mind creates the suffering and the soul. Consider where you have come from, where you are going after giving up this body, and why you're under the control of material lamentation. Try to understand your real position in this way, and then you'll be able to give up your unnecessary attachment. You will also be able to give up the belief that this material world or anything not directly in touch with service to Krishna is eternal. Thus, you will obtain peace. Important message here. In the purport, the Krishna consciousness movement is factually endeavouring to bring human society to a sober condition. Because of the misdirected civilization, people are jumping in materialistic life like cats and dogs, performing all sorts of abominable sinful actions and becoming increasingly entangled. The Krishna consciousness movement includes self-realization, because one is first directed by Lord Krishna to understand that one is not the body, but the owner of the body. When one understands this simple fact, he can direct himself toward the goal of life. Because people are not educated in terms of the goal of life, they are working like madmen and becoming more and more attached to the material atmosphere. The misguided man accepts material condition as everlasting. One must give up his faith in material things and give up attachment for them. Then one will be sober and peaceful. The great sage Narada continued, "My dear king, attentively receive from me a mantra which is most auspicious. After accepting it from me, in 7 nights you'll be able to see the Lord face to face. My dear king, in former days, Lord Shiva and other demigods took shelter of the lotus feet of Sankarshan. Thus they immediately got free from the illusion of duality and achieved unequaled and unsurpassed glories in spiritual life. You'll very soon attain that very same position." So we discussed previously that Ritashura prayed to Sankarshan, right? That was his... Yeah. And now we're hearing why. Because in this life as Chitraketu, he was, you know, he met, as we'll see in the next chapter, he meets Lord Sankarshan by chanting this mantra. And I've told you the story that, you know, of course, Sankarshan is the presiding deity of ego. Ego itself. Ego itself, because in the spiritual world, you know, he manifests all the living entities. And each one of them is given their spiritual ego, identity. And in the material world, he manages their false ego, you know, like that. So he can, to become free from the false ego, the bodily conception of life, bodily, mental, one meditates upon Lord Sankarshan. So when we received the Sankarshan, my spiritual master, he was upstairs here in Melbourne, he had him in like a cardboard, it was a, you know, a clean box that had a new soap in it, and so you could see that it was a soap box, it was all colourful, and he said, "What's in here, Gangeshwara, is not soap, but it will cleanse you of your material body." So in the next chapter, we're going to hear all about Lord Sankarshan. Very, very beautiful. There's about 60 verses or something, but really interesting chapter about Chitraketu meeting Sankarshan. Lord Sankarshan will be coming along. He'd like to hear everyone, you know, enjoying his association. We'll be meeting him. So next Saturday, I don't think there's any disruptions, no, so we'll all be here. Lord willing. You never know what happens when your feet leave the door. As the Hobbit said in Lord of the Rings, you never know what happens to you when your feet, you know, exit your home. He went on a whole adventure that he never expected. But anyway, by Lord Sankarshan's grace, may we all meet back here next week and enjoy the next chapter. And then the chapter after that is how Chitraketu was cursed by Parvati because he laughed at Lord Shiva and became Vritasura, right? Now, so there's two chapters there, and then we may do the exam. Because the last two chapters, they sort of continue to discuss the descendants of Kashyapa. Remember how we heard that Kashyapa populated the universe with the birds and the reptiles. He had different wives, including deity and the deity especially. So then the last two chapters deal with that and how Indra wanted to kill one of the descendants when deity was pregnant like that. So that's sort of in that vein. But that may not necessarily be in the exam. So after we've done these two, we may, 16 and 17, we may then look at doing the exam and then finishing off the chapter after that and then getting into helping to, then the last one, just doing presentations on what it means to be a Bhaktivaibhavi, which I can, help you with. And then after that, of course, it'll be helping you to finish off anything that's unfinished, from previous essays and what have you. All right then, thank you very much. Wonderful to be here again. Wonderful to see you all again. And so much inspiration for me. And it gives me a lot of strength. I didn't think I was going to get through the whole class, but somehow I did. And it's the grace of the Lord. We'll see you next week. Thank you very much. All right then.
Sorry, just one question. Yes. Does this show Chitraketu's purity? Because he says just in 7 days you'll see the Lord. So he actually was a Mahabhagavata who fell down?
He's already considered to be a very advanced devotee, that's right, yeah. And that's why, there's not far for him to go. And of course, we also have to understand the spiritual potency of Narada Muni.
Of course.
All right then. And the mercy of Lord Sankarshan. So, here's the Tulsi.
Oh, that's great.
The Mahatma.
What's his wife's name?
Sarada Radha.